Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. A man who has been tracking parts of the war for the free world for decades and often looking hard at parts of the battle space that the rest of us overlook all too often, but potentially to the great peril of our country, is Peter Husey. He is a longtime Capitol Hill and executive branch hand and public policy maven on national security matters. These days, he is the director of strategic deterrence studies at the Mitchell Institute, and always a welcome guest here. Peter, it's good to have you with us. Welcome back.
Thank you, Frank. I always appreciate being on your show.
Thank you. We look forward to your insights on nuclear forces, particularly, Peter, and what is happening in that domain. Again, all too often, this is the domain of specialists who have arcane and usually very sub rosa conversations with each other about arms control, for example, and the like. Our job is to sort of showcase some of this. The New START treaty that was negotiated during the Obama administration is about to expire. Joe Biden, who is presenting himself as the president-elect, presumably have this as one of the first orders of business were he to come to power, or the administration of Donald Trump will have to deal with this as well. Give us quickly the lay of the land on New START and what you think might come next.
Well, thank you, Frank. I'm going to try to do this quickly and then simply. Is the New START treaty basically keeps, if you think the Russians are agreeing to it, about 2,200 warheads. The language of the treaty says 1,550, but bombers can have as many weapons as you want on them, up to 60 bombers. So that gets you up beyond 2,000, which is about where we were with the Moscow Treaty of 2003 that George Bush signed with Mr. Putin. So we're basically, for 20 years, have basically been stuck at 2,000. And the question is, extending the treaty does what? And extending the treaty, what's the bad side? Because there's ups and downs. One is, you think the Russians are agreeing to it, extending the treaty means that we won't have to give up like SDI or some portion of our nuclear forces to get this arms control agreement extended, because it is extended just by, hey, do it. The problem is that verification is bad for this treaty compared to earlier treaties. Number two, the Russian ability to break out, meaning build up, is huge, because so many of their missiles have multiple warheads as opposed to ours. 400 of our 700 missiles and bombers have only a single warhead. So you have that upload, which should happen relatively quickly. Plus, the Russians can build up to 4,000 warheads a year. We can't build a dozen. So if warheads matter, to me, that's an issue. If they don't matter, if you don't care, but every arms control deal we've signed with Russia since the SALT treaties back in the 1970s, Congress has insisted in what they call parity, meaning we have basically the same in terms of long-range strategic weapons. The other issue, which is, of course, important, is that Russians have 5,000 or so low-range, low-yield, short-range missiles we call theater weapons, none of which are under any control because it's so difficult to verify where they are. The final point is, China has a free ride, irrespective of whether we extend the treaty or not, because they're not under any limits whatsoever on arms control with respect to nuclear weapons, and refuse to even discuss whether they should be.
You know, this sounds like pretty much a dog's breakfast, I think is the technical term for it. It doesn't sound as though you think this treaty will restrict the Russians, that it won't restrict the Chinese at all. It probably will have the effect that these things usually do of restricting the United States. And that's without even getting to some of the ideas that people like Adam Smith, the chairman of the House Armed Services Committee, say not only he endorses, but that the Biden-Harris team would endorse for essentially wild unilateral disarmament of our nuclear deterrent. Talk a little bit about how all this nets out in terms of our security, Peter.
Well, Steve Blank, as you know, and I just wrote a piece for Gatestone on exactly this subject. There are pluses and minuses. The pluses are, supposedly, Adam Smith has said, Congress should support nuclear modernization if we do arms control. Well, we're going to get arms control if Mr. Biden is president, and it'll be five more years. As I said, it doesn't solve a serious number of problems. But many in the military say that as long as Russia, we can determine whether Russia is roughly abiding by the treaty, they find value in what they call that transparency. The issue, though, is the arms control community has said the deal that was made in 2010 between Senator Kyle of the Senate and Jim Miller of the Pentagon under Obama was, hey, you support arms control in the Senate and sign the go ahead with the treaty, we'll support nuclear modernization over the next decades. And we'll put money in the budget to do that. The arms control community is now saying that deal is gone. So what they're saying is, many of them are saying, unilaterally kill 400 Minuteman missiles out of 700 missiles and bombers were allowed under the treaty. Kill the cruise missile for the bomber, which means bombers would have to penetrate Russia rather than stand off thousands of miles, 1,600 miles away and launch cruise missiles. And they've even talked about cutting the number of submarines from 12 down to as low as 6. As I was talking to a number of people yesterday, 6 submarines total in our force means that 1 or 2 might be at sea at any one time, and it'd be tough to cover both the Pacific and Atlantic Ocean. So that's you nailed it. That's the fight now is, will Congress and the new administration support nuclear modernization? I think the Republican Party, no problem. I think many in the Democratic Party, like Senator Tester of Montana, no problem. Chairman House Member Cooper from Tennessee, he's been very much in favor of nuclear modernization. But as you said, Adam Smith is chairman of that House committee. He's talked about going to a minimal deterrent of like 300 warheads. And this is going to be a fight. And unfortunately, a lot of friends have told me who were in the previous administration, in the Democratic administration under Obama, said ICBMs, land-based missiles, and the cruise missile for the bombers will be on the table for consideration for elimination, and they all said the same thing to me. I hope adults are in the room when they make the decision, because they're all in favor of it.
It's not clear to me that there will be adults in the room. We'll be talking shortly with our friend Ken Timmerman about some of the folks who will be around that table if there is, in fact, a Biden-Harris administration. But Peter, I just have to say, listening to you talk about it sounds like Lucy and the football. It sounds like the same sort of nonsense that we've heard consistently from people. Oh, yes, we'll modernize as long as there's arms control. Well, the Russians, to say nothing of what the Chinese might do, were they in the mix, are past masters at using arms control negotiations or pressure or what have you to keep us from modernizing our force. And let me just conclude by saying the Russians have fully modernized their nuclear forces. And so the disparity is all the greater. Peter, we're out of time. I have to leave it at this. But I just want to say thank you for your assessment of what's on offer here. Thanks, but no thanks seems to me to be the appropriate response. But we'll be talking more with you about this in the days ahead. Seeing who is going to be at the table will be a critical question, of course, but it's very troubling what you've shared with us. Thank you, my friend. Come back to us again soon. Meantime, I know you'll keep up the good work at the Marshall Institute. Next up, we'll speak with Ken Timmerman, as promised, right after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
We're back. It's a pleasure to say, joined by Kenneth Timmerman, one of our time's most, I think, formidable and highly regarded investigative journalists, as well as an essayist and author of fiction and nonfiction works of considerable renown. He is most recently the author of a novel that turns out to have been more a prediction than a work of fiction. It is entitled The Election Heist. We're going to start with that, Ken Timmerman. It's good to have you back. Welcome.
Yeah, Frank, it's good to be with you. Thanks.
Well, it certainly seems as though there's been a heist. The president talked about it at length yesterday in an address delivered from the White House. Talk a little bit about what we have seen to date. Ken Timmerman, in the way of fraud? And why is it that we are incessantly told by the media, legacy and so-called social, that there's nothing to see here, folks? Move along. We have a president-elect and just get on with it.
Frank, look, I think this is an extraordinary time in our history, perhaps the most extraordinary time since the American Revolution. I think of it a little bit like the Wizard of Oz in real life, or my book, The Election Heist, in real life. You know, the fun thing about fiction is that you get to see the conspiracy. You get to the mastermind behind the plot has a name, right? He's got a face. He does things that you can put together. You see his operations. That's how you know in the election heist who is making things happen. In the real life, in the real world, we don't know who's making those things happen. That's what investigators, we used to have investigative journalists, are supposed to do. Prosecutors and investigative reporters, they're supposed to connect the dots.
Doesn't seem to be a lot of that happening at the moment, apart from your good self. So what do you think we can say, as far as the case has been made so far, about who's behind it and whether they're likely to get away with it?
Well, I think the group, in addition to Rudy Giuliani, who's done just amazing work, is Phil Klein and the Amistad Project at the Thomas More Center. They had a press conference a couple of days ago with whistleblowers who were contractors to the United States Postal Service. One guy was a truck driver, and he personally he found out that he had actually carried a tractor trailer load of marked ballots from a center in New York into Pennsylvania, where they mysteriously disappeared and then reappeared as if by magic in Milwaukee and Philadelphia and Detroit. This was a massive operation, a huge operation.
A premeditated operation.
And a premeditated operation. It was, and you can see that by the way things took place. If you actually examine events, you'll see they didn't happen by coincidence, comrade. These were planned and they were financed. Mark Zuckerberg was approached by persons
of Facebook fame, of course.
Yes, of Facebook fame, to donate $400 million to a little-known left-wing group to then distribute among get-out-the-vote operations and to pay poll workers all across the United States. He wrote these as grants.
This is what used to be called walking around money in the dirty world of politics. Now it's a tax-deductible contribution, I take it.
Right, a tax-deductible contribution. And he paid people right down to the poll workers. So when you hear these statements, affidavits, sworn affidavits from witnesses in some of Rudy Giuliani's cases in Michigan and elsewhere of how Republican poll watchers were treated by the election officials, well, those election officials were paid by Mark Zuckerberg via these left-wing groups. Now, I don't think Mark Zuckerberg is the mastermind. He may have been the money, but he's not the mastermind.
And he's probably only some of the money, too.
Yeah, there is a second $400 million as well. But, if I were the FBI, I would bring Mark Zuckerberg to a hotel suite and have a nice conversation with him to discover who actually convinced him to pony up $400 million.
Yes. And where did the second $400 million come from, as best you can tell?
Well, the second $400 million we now learn from, the Securities and Exchange Commission filings about 2 months ago. We learned that a Chinese bank just pumped $400 million into the holding company that owns Dominion Voting Systems 2 months before the election. A Chinese bank.
So we have evidence in this Dominion business of the Venezuelans, the Serbians, possibly Germans, certainly Spaniards, Cubans, perhaps very definitely it seems Chinese. Ken Timmerman, based on your in-depth understanding of these kinds of actors, as well as your very impressive prognostication as to what was likely to happen, as written up in your fiction entitled The Election Heist. Is there any doubt in your mind that we not only had massive fraud here in the United States, but we had foreign operations intensifying that fraud? The president said yesterday in his remarks, way more votes were affected than are needed to resolve this election in his favor. But does that sound right to you?
Frank, we had willing cooperation from foreign partners. And you mentioned all those people, plus the Iranians. We know that some of the traffic from the Dominion servers went to Spain, to Germany, but also to Iran. Unbelievable, but that's the testimony of a former U.S. Defense Intelligence cyber expert in Arizona earlier this week, who examined the network packets and where they had gone. So yes, this was a massive operation. I happen to believe that the mastermind is right here in the United States. That's why I think the FBI should be talking to Mark Zuckerberg. And I happen to believe that mastermind was closely coordinating this operation with the Democrat National Committee.
Ken, this brings us to the second topic that I wanted to talk to you about. If, in fact, Joe Biden is perpetrating, or at least is the beneficiary of, a massive fraud on the American voters, the concern about this can only be intensified by the kind of people he's proposing put into positions of trust, and should he become, in fact, president of the United States. You've written a very powerful indictment of a number of these people at the Epoch Times recently, and I wanted you just to give us a flavor. Focus is best, I think, for this purpose, on the national security-related team, many of whom have now been designated. But tell us a little bit about the cast of characters and what those of us who don't have your impressive corporate memory should know about some of these, Obama-Biden sort of throwbacks.
Yes, I call them the B team. The leftovers from the Obama, Biden, and in some cases the Clinton administration. Let's start with Tony Blinken, the Secretary of State designate in a potential Biden-Harris administration. Tony Blinken is one of the authors of the Iran deal. And I know our listeners are very well familiar with why this was probably the worst foreign policy negotiation ever made by a U.S. government. He also is on the board as somebody who apparently is of counsel now, or not actively engaged with the board of an investment company that is literally, explicitly, in black and white, selling access to future government officials, saying there's going to be all kinds of defense contracts that are going to be let out by the new administration, and we're in a position through our contacts and our partners to give you access such as you've never had before. Unbelievable corruption, explicit in the text, in an investment offering. You've got a gentleman who was in the Obama administration at Citizenship Immigration Services, who's now going to be in charge of immigration in this country, who sold...
And Homeland Security.
Homeland Security. Yeah, right. As the Secretary of Homeland Security, who sold visas to communist Chinese investors for $500,000. They would get a green card and a ticket to citizenship all through the 1990s, these investor visas. You've got a White House advisor who has had corrupt relations very explicitly with foreign governments. I mean, it's just unbelievable the type of, we call it the Biden crime family for a reason, Frank. All of these people.
It would be the Biden crime government, I guess one might say, if people are going to continue to practice as they have in the past. So, Ken, these two factors would both seem to be disqualifying for the so-called president-elect Joe Biden. Do you anticipate that he would be short-lived as president were he actually to make it, that the Democratic Party would recognize suddenly that this is a problem and push him over the side in favor of Kamala Harris, who, if anything, has even more troubling connections to, or certainly political affinities for, the Maoists and Chinese communists, I think?
Yeah, I think they're in this together, Frank. And I'm not sure it makes much difference who is at the head of government. It just depends whether you want to be scolded by a school marm or you want to laugh at the goofy uncle. What is your, which way do you prefer to be duped?
Choose your poison, as they say. Neither is a very attractive option. So all the more reason why I think the president is absolutely right. We've got to make sure that every legal vote is counted and none of the illegal ones. Folks, you can find out more about this at everylegalvote.com. I commend that to you, as well as the terrific work of Not So Much Fiction by our guest, Ken Timmerman, The Election Heist. Ken, come back to us soon with updates on all of this, if you would. This is riveting and chilling, but we need more of it in the future, needless to say. Next up, we will speak with Robert Spencer about the Muslim Brotherhood at home and abroad and what it's gunning for, namely you. That and more, straight ahead.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back, and it's a special privilege to say welcome to an old friend and valued colleague, now a senior fellow of the Center for Security Policy, as well as the director of Jihad Watch, a weekly columnist for PJ Media and Front Page Magazine, and the author of 21, count them, 21 books, including most recently one for the Center for Security Policy Press, Mass Migration in Europe. This is, of course, Robert Spencer I'm talking about. Robert, it's good to have you with us, sir. Welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio. So good to have you.
Thanks. Always good to talk to you, Frank. Thank you.
I had two topics that I wanted to cover with you today. Rashida Tlaib, member of Congress from Michigan, has retweeted one of the most vile characterizations of the agenda of those who seek the elimination of the State of Israel. And it's astonishing that somebody, you know, would be willing to say that in her position, but remind us what that's about, Robert, not just the statement itself, but what it means in the vision of its advocates.
Yeah, Rashida Tlaib recently retweeted a statement, "From the river to the sea, Palestine will be free." Now, this is a neat little rhyme, and it's increasingly popular among pro-Palestinian activists, but giving it a moment's thought reveals just how insidious it is. From the river, that is the Jordan, to the sea, the Mediterranean, Palestine will be free. It means essentially that there will be no Israel at all. Not that there will be peace, not that there will be a Palestinian state side by side living in peace with Israel, but no Israel at all. Because when you go from the river to the sea, that doesn't leave any room for anything else but this free Palestine that they're envisioning. And so what they're talking about is total destruction of Israel, which inevitably would involve a new genocide of the Jews and the deaths of millions of people.
Judenrein, to call it by its German phrase in the Third Reich. So we have to hold people like this accountable, it seems to me, and yet it seems as though a cast of characters is emerging under the banner of a putative Biden-Harris administration who, far from rejecting this kind of rhetoric or policy approach, seem to be, well, if not explicitly embracing it, certainly associating with and seemingly plighting their troth, to use an old phrase, to some of its champions, including the Muslim Brotherhood front organizations operating in this country, who have become clearly much enamored of the Biden team and would seemingly expect to be favored by them. Talk a little bit about why that might operate, Robert, if you would, and then perhaps any insights you have into the kind of people that this administration is looking at bringing aboard who have some of these qualities and very troubling ones at that.
Biden has promised, he promised during the summer, that he would place Muslims at every level of his administration. And what was disquieting about that was that he said that in a conference of Engage, which is a Muslim Brotherhood-linked organization trying to encourage Muslims to vote and to elect Muslims to various positions at state, local, and national levels. Now, there's nothing wrong with that in itself, except that because it's a Muslim Brotherhood-linked organization, the people that they're going to try to bring into the government are dedicated to goals that are quite different from those of the U.S. Constitution. Most disturbing in the Biden administration, apparently to be, is Rima Doden, who has been appointed Deputy Director of the White House Office of Legislative Affairs. And she's somebody who openly expressed sympathy for the jihad suicide bombings of innocent civilians. Now, this was in 2002, and people say, well, that was so many years ago. People can grow, people can change. But there's no indication that she's repudiated the sentiment. And it's also worth noting, Frank, that the Biden administration would never dream of hiring somebody who said in 2002, for example, Islam is not a religion of peace, or something like that. They're quite forgiving, in other words, in regard to viciously anti-Israel statements that encourage or approve of violence. And they would not be in the least forgiving about other kinds of statements that don't go in line with their agenda. And so that is disquieting in terms of what it shows that the Biden administration is going to be like, apparently even more hostile to Israel than the Obama administration.
Well, what's so worrying about this, Robert Spencer? And you have more authoritatively, perhaps than anybody I can think of at least, documented this fact. It's not just anti-Israel when people like this espouse suicide bombing. I mean, this is Sharia supremacism. This is the idea of jihad to be wielded against anybody who does not embrace their full-on doctrine and submit to it, is it not? So it's a problem for America, in other words, not just for its most important friend and ally in the Middle East, Israel.
Well, yes, there's no doubt. As far as the global jihad forces are concerned, and that includes the Muslim Brotherhood, America and Israel are not separable. It's the great Satan and the little Satan. And, you know, people speak about the great Satan and the little Satan in terms of Iran and in terms of their extravagant rhetoric and so on. But it's not just an Iranian thing. As a matter of fact, the great Satan and little Satan in reality are two stone pillars in Mecca that the pilgrims to Mecca stone as part of their pilgrimage. And so to identify America and Israel with the two of them is to say that all of Islam should be at war with America and Israel. Now, obviously, not every Muslim believes that, but there are far too many who do, both Sunnis and Shia, and among the Brotherhood as well. So when they denounce Israel, they think of America as Israel's foremost patron, friend, and ally, and consequently, they're making war against both.
So when you hear that the Obama-Biden team is talking about putting such individuals in places of power and influence, and that their hostility is not just towards Christians and Jews elsewhere, but here, the point is underscored really by what we're seeing in terms of that hostility playing out in some parts of the world. And we don't have time to do justice to this in the fullness of what is afoot. But let me just ask you about two incidents that have happened in very recent days, Robert Spencer, both in Africa, one in the Congo and one in Nigeria. And again, we're selecting incidents out of a much larger context in both of those countries, by the way. But give us a flavor of what Sharia supremacism and jihadism translates into at the moment in these places and what it might mean for other places, including right here at home, if we're not careful.
People aren't aware, but there are a jihad group, violent jihad groups, in several areas of Africa that are dedicated, in their own words, to establishing Sharia by force. And one of them is the Allied Democratic Forces, the ADF, very little known in the West. But recently in the Democratic Republic of the Congo, they entered a Christian village and called upon the Christians to convert to Islam. And when they refused, they murdered 20 of them. And this is something that, unfortunately, is not limited just to Congo. We have seen actions of the same kind in Somalia, where another jihad group that wants to establish Sharia, Al-Shabaab, has also separated Muslims from Christians and then killed the Christians. And in Nigeria recently, what you're referring to is the slaughter of 110 rice farmers by Fulani herdsmen. And this is often characterized in the West as a conflict between the nomadic herdsmen and the stationary farmers. But as it happens, the farmers are all Christians and the herdsmen are all Muslims, and the herdsmen are attacking them very clearly, singling out Christians and making it into a religious conflict, as many of the Christian clerics in Nigeria have themselves pointed out. And in all these three cases and many others, they want to establish Sharia, and they are waging war in order to do so. And because it's in poor countries in Africa, I think it gets scant attention in the West, even though it has tremendous implications if they succeed there for the rest of the world.
You use the term slaughter. What happened, as I understand it, was that these 110 rice farmers, these Christians who were singled out, as you say, this murderous attack, were actually beheaded, every last one of them. And why is that important in terms of the traditions of jihad, Robert, both in terms of the practice of emulating Muhammad's perfect man example, but also the psychological horror that this inflicts on the people most immediately affected, of course, but also others who might be contemplating resisting the jihad?
Well, there are two Quran verses that are at play in this, and one is, strike terror in the hearts of the enemies of Allah. That's chapter 8, verse 60. And then when you meet the unbelievers, strike the neck. That's chapter 47, verse 4. So beheading the rice farmers is just another example of attempting to do both, striking terror in the area population when they find out what's happened, and also declaring the victims to be unbelievers, actually, by beheading them, which is the Quran's punishment for unbelief, in as per 47:4.
And per the actual personal experience of Muhammad himself, who beheaded, what was it, some 300 Jews at one point?
Between 600 and 900, yeah.
This is chilling stuff, Robert Spencer, needless to say, but you're warning us of it, as you did in your terrific new book at the Center for Security Policy Press, Mass Migration in Europe, because it is not likely to remain confined overseas. This is an ambition that, unfortunately, not all Muslims, but Sharia supremacists have for all of us, and we are on notice about it. We have to leave it at that. Robert, come back to us again soon, if you would. I hope for a longer conversation about mass migration in Europe, among other things. I look forward to doing that with you soon. In the meantime, I know you'll keep up the terrific work you do at Jihad Watch. Check it out at jihadwatch.org. Next up, we'll speak with Tenzin Sampo, a leader of the Tibetan community in the United States, about the need to designate the Chinese Communist Party as what it is, a transnational criminal organization. That and more, straight ahead.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back, and it's a pleasure to say we are joined by a member of a very special delegation of what we call the Captive Nations Coalition that have come together here in Washington, D.C. to present the case to the Trump administration and to members of Congress and to others that this is a moment when the Chinese Communist Party should be recognized for what it is. A transnational criminal organization. Our guest's name is Tenzin Sampo. He is a member of the board of the U.S. Tibet Committee and works closely with the Tibetan expatriate community in New York City, which is the largest outside of Tibet, a nation that has been enslaved by the Chinese Communist Party for decades under extremely oppressive conditions, some of which seem to be worsening at the moment. We're glad to catch up with Tenzin. Thank you so much for taking a few minutes to talk with us about this important mission you're about and the state of Tibet at the moment at the hands of the Chinese Communist Party. It's good to have you with us, Tenzin. Welcome. So remind us about how an independent Tibet became enslaved at the hands of the Chinese Communist Party. When did it happen and under what circumstances?
Yes, Tibet was fully an independent sovereign nation before the Chinese invasion early 1950. They invaded the part of eastern Tibet 1950 starting, and then they forced the Tibetan government in Lhasa, Tibet, to have a negotiation in Beijing. And they said, if you're not going to negotiate, we're going to continue to march on and slaughter and invade. And the Tibetan government didn't have much choice. Dalai Lama felt unsafe. He went towards India to escape. But at the end, they had to send five delegations to Beijing and negotiate. It's later known as the 17-point agreement, which was interrupted many, many times and for days at the end. And they were forced to sign the 17-point agreement. And this agreement was actually basically, just like in Hong Kong, national security law, that Tibet is going to be part of China. It's an autonomous region of China, which never happened in the history of Tibet for over 2,000 years. And they didn't want to sign, but the Chinese said, you have to sign it, and they're going to be personally violence on their, personal safety and physically. But the Tibetan delegations, they didn't want to show the actual seal of the Tibetan government. And then Chinese made the seal in the stamp in China, and then they signed it 1951 May 23rd, and it's called the 17-point agreement.
Essentially, Tibet was conquered. Its spiritual leader, the Dalai Lama, was forced to flee and has lived in exile ever since. It is a beautiful country, but its culture and its marvelous monasteries and other edifices and the country itself, notably its waters, have been despoiled, if not physically destroyed, by the Chinese Communist Party. Is that right?
Yes. Ever since the Chinese won, just to give what happened was since 1959, when the Tibetans decided to revolt and there was 80,000 Tibetans killed during the Chinese invasion, 1959, March 10th, Dalai Lama had to escape to India, and thousands of Tibetans escaped to India, Nepal, and Bhutan. And then since 1959, until 1980s, there were 6,000 Tibetan monasteries were destroyed, burned to the ground. 6,000 Tibetan religion, culture, language was diminished. And Tibetan is the source of all the waters in the world. It's been used, and the deep forest, thousands of forest acres. So it has been a disaster under the Chinese government. And the Tibetans were treated as worse than second-class citizens. They even can't worship the Dalai Lama or do religious practice or keep their traditions. It's been a horrible, horrible...
These are crimes against humanity. And as we were talking about yesterday with one of your other colleagues from the area of East Turkestan, Uyghur Muslim by the name of Kabinur Geni, the brutality that has been meted out and is continuing, if not actually intensifying, vis-a-vis the Tibetans, is akin to what is happening to the Uyghur Muslims as well, is it not, in concentration camps and enslavement of various kinds, forced labor and the like?
Yes. Actually, this guy now, who is the head of the Xinjiang, East Turkestan, he was in Tibet 2012 until 2016. So they see that Tibet is a laboratory for all the atrocities and the horrible regimes that implement any wants to crush or
Yes.
Well, this is really the point. Yes, there's this practice, and it's not unique to any one of these regions. It's being meted out to people throughout what China now calls its territory. Let me ask you about the mission that brings you here. And again, our guest is Tenzin Sampo of the U.S. Tibet Committee. Talk a little bit about the importance to your community of having this criminal enterprise, the Chinese Communist Party, designated as such, a transnational criminal organization. Why does that matter, and why should the United States do that?
Yes, it's absolutely, it's high time that we have to label this criminal organization as it is, transnational criminal organization. You know, I live in New York. New York is the biggest Tibetan community in the Western Hemisphere after, India. And there are huge Tibetan community, in the United States. I have daily contact with them. I work with them. I, do a lot of social work, volunteer work. And they all hate the Chinese government. We escaped from the Chinese autocracy. And this is the Chinese government should be exactly what it is supposed to be. And that will threaten the freedom, the freedom of speech, the freedom of travel, worship, your keeping your tradition. I mean, this is going on for last 61 years for the Tibetans, and it's happened to the Xinjiang, the East Turkestan. It's now going to happen in the Hong Kong. And it's if we don't label them correctly, the trans criminal organization, this Chinese government, it will be throughout the world. In the Belt and Road is coming to Chinese. Economy is influencing throughout. And even the United States, a lot of people are not getting it, not grasping what the Chinese government. We live there. We know the Chinese government so well. And it is a criminal organization. It will be affect every single life in the United States. You just can't say they can't do it. This is very dangerous economically, militarily, politically. Everything, we have to be vigilant, and we have to make sure that Chinese government will not threaten the U.S., United States, the security, national security, and the way of living. This is a dangerous time, and a lot of, the globalists, whatever, we have to look after the American people first and see the Chinese threat right through, or after 5-10 years, we will be, begging mercies, and the Chinese will have no mercy on us. So United States government, especially the government, the important government, they have to know what has been doing for the Tibet, the East Turkestan, and, the Southern Mongolians, and now Hong Kong. It's dangerous. It is dangerous for us. We have to be vigilant, and we have to stop it now, or we will never get out of it. And the Chinese will never have mercy on America. And we'll be only regretting, other than that, there's not much to do. So it's time that we have to identify this criminal organization as a trans-criminal organization.
Tenzin Sampo, thank you so much for your time today and for making the trip here to Washington, D.C. to impress upon our government both what is at stake for America as well as for the world if the Chinese Communist Party is able to get away with murder, among other things, other criminal activities. God bless you. It's good to talk with you, sir. Come back to us again soon if you would. I hope the rest of you will come back to us again, same time, same station, tomorrow. Until then, this is Frank Affney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.